All right, hi everybody. I'm Joe. Joe Benitez, a new faculty at University of Louisville, and I actually have no formal relationship with the Black Women's Health Imperative or the Black Women's Health Study. But I was kindly asked by Linda to sit on this panel, and I am very appreciative of that. And I hope to offer a different perspective, not just different, but something that I think will be complementary in how you look at health disparities facing Black women, as well as Black women, as well as other minority ethnic groups as well, going in the future, and not just the adverse effects of it, but kind of the drain on the economy and productivity, essentially how much is being lost if disparities were to persist over time. So I actually don't have any financial disclosures or financial disclosure to provide. So, yeah, there that is. No financial relationships. So, to begin, I'm just going to give a little bit of an overview of essentially the economics of health disparities. So, kind of what that actually looks like. What are the drains that disparities place on the economy, and how that actually affects that people at the individual level, because when people think of economics, they think about national income. I tend to think of it more at a micro level, so how it affects your earnings or your human capital acquisition, mainly your ability to invest in yourself, so acquire education, acquire new skills, particularly if you think about infants being born to poor conditions. They're going to face these adverse effects over the course of a lifetime that's going to compound. So it's not just a one-time thing where these disparities occur, but they affect people over the life course. So that's one of the things I think needs to be better communicated, at least in the literature, when discussing disparities and the adverse effects of them. And then disparities affect your productivity. If you've been beaten down by society, or you've had to deal with continual structural racism, it's going to affect your productivity, so you're not able to produce, have a labor product. So essentially you're not working at your best ability if you're facing these disadvantages over the course of a lifetime. Then I kind of want to, so that was kind of the overview of what I want to talk about, but I also think of it as a framework for how you think about disparities in the economic sense. I anticipate if returning particularly Black women to full health, the economic returns are large, meaning that the economy is going to be more productive, meaning larger gross domestic product, which means that everybody's going to be made more well off. So not just Black women themselves, but everyone. And to my surprise, there's actually not a lot of research in this area on the economics of adverse health among Black women. So for me, that's great, because that gives me some work to do. But at the same time, it's kind of unfortunate that there's not been looked at rigorously over time to really put this in the context of a policy discussion. So just kind of, for me, especially with, to complement the Black Women's Health Study, like the major findings that were interesting to me, and I think other economists, particularly about income and education, you know, them being related to better self-reported health, which, as we've seen in a lot of other studies, self-reported health tends to be a good indicator of future mortality rates. So that people with better self-reported health, they tend to live longer, they tend to have other healthier lifestyles. So then I think, you know, operating in a way that helps people feel healthier, that's one mechanism that you can actually exploit to actually improve women's health, particularly if you're shifting it forward. So not just getting everyone at full health, but even just making them one unit healthier. And if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me. I'm very comfortable with, being stopped at any point. So feel free to ask questions at any point in the presentation. But main thing is I wanted to think about these in context for future economic inquiry as well as policy framing. So not just that there's some moral obligations to addressing disparities, but it costs, you know, a lot of money for these disparities to continue. So while most of them tend to come from a social justice perspective, I think the argument becomes even stronger when you show how much is actually being lost if these disparities were to continue. So not just saying, okay, that there is some economic loss, but being able to characterize the size as well as the sources of the economic burden attributable to poor health status, mainly through earnings, productivity, having a larger number of unhealthy work days, or just showing up at work unhealthier than your counterparts, you're not going to be as productive. So you're not as, say, mobile. So that prohibits your ability to compete for advancement or compete for other jobs. So I think that those are some of the things that would be included in the value of addressing disparities. So we can think of it in two main ways in how disparities would operate. So I think what I've given is probably mostly in the indirect costs of care, but some of the direct costs are really just a lot of the actual disparities within the healthcare system. So if you say that there's differential treatment for black women when they show up in the hospital compared to their counterparts, but then even larger tend to be the indirect, which would be labor market productivity or inadequate access to other sources of inadequate access to coverage, educational acquisition, lower income, as well as more likely to be exposed to adverse social determinants. So just citing the few things that are in the literature. So, and this is just over a 4-year period. So just if you add up all of in the direct costs of health disparities, particularly for Asians, blacks, and Latinos, $229 billion over a 4-year period from 2003. And these are just from that period. If you were to look today, I would expect that they'd be slightly larger because, one, for inflation, but also for that these disparities are likely to persist over time and be even more compounded. At the same period of time, the indirect costs, which unhealthy work days, a less healthy workforce, cost the economy over $1 trillion is their estimate over time. And I'm a lowly assistant professor, and I don't know about you guys, but $1.2 trillion is a lot of money to me. So I think that's a very good place to start with as far as, okay, how big that number actually means and what is the drain on the economy. So then just in $24 billion in a later study looked at it for just 1 year. $24 billion is still a fairly large number, and the expectation is that if left unchecked, the number would grow annually to reaching more than $50 billion annually by 2050 if the current patterns continue. So, and this kind of strikes out as interesting to me because I was able to find a study for that focused on the adverse effects on the economy for black men, but not for black women. So it's kind of where I see it as an opportunity for research in that area and to kind of see what that actually looks like. So $24 billion in direct excess medical expenses and $317 billion in a 1-year period on the economy. And then $115 billion for Latino men. In that same year by the same people doing the study. So kind of where I think is future opportunities. So complementing the results and the findings of the Black Women's Health Study, as well as other rigorous investigations into disparities and the implications, their implications on Black women over time, to really start to investigate the economic returns to improving Black women's health status, also to determine the size of the burden, and then to include that, to use that information as a supplement to the epidemiologic information, particularly provided by researchers such as Tracy and her colleagues with the Black Women's Health Studies. So that's all I have to say, but if you have any questions, please feel free to contact me. This is my email above, and I'm, oh, yes. And, excuse me?
Were you able to break down or get a sense of general what
the
medical is?
Oh, okay. So, sure. Okay. So, from what I remember in the papers, a lot of it was attributable to showing up later and often at more severe, so as opposed to, say, if you're on the spectrum of primary, secondary, versus, tertiary care, where tertiary care would likely be the most expensive, or you're acting okay, now you have to act more aggressively in the hospital. It tends to be more on the tertiary side where people are actually showing up. So if you think about, particularly in cancer, when Black women tend to show up, they're more frequently able to showing up with cancer in the later stage. I'm not as familiar with the cancer literature, so that's my apologies, but so they're more likely to show up with cancer that's already been aggressive as opposed to it showing up in the earlier stages. So that's one of the plausible reasons on why the direct medical expenditures are higher. Sure. Any other? Yes.
Can you all hear me? Okay. So thank you all for coming, and I'm really glad that we get a chance to spend some time together and talk about this issue. And thank you, Dr. Richardson, for that comment, because hopefully most of you in this room, like certainly we are tired of talking about what's wrong with Black women. Because as the research from the health study shows, there's actually more right with us than is wrong with us. And that's where I want to focus this conversation, but also the research going forward. Because honestly, I don't know that we need to do any more disparities research. I think we pretty much know what's going on, but we need to really focus on, what happens next. So I've got no financial relationships to disclose, and if anyone is inclined to social media, there's a couple Twitter handles. So just a little bit of background. Hopefully this woman looks familiar to most of you. Billie Avery founded the Black Women's Health Project in 1983. She brought a few of her friends together, a couple thousand of them, to talk about Black women's health and what Black women can do about Black women's health and how to improve Black women's health and the fact that it is our responsibility. She and her friends and sister feminists fully acknowledge structural barriers that we'll talk a little bit about. But Billy said, we've got to do this. This is our problem to solve. And so for the last 32 years, that's what now the Black Women's Health Imperative has been focused on. As Dr. Wright said, I've been on the job about a year and a half. And it's just been a privilege and a thrill for me to work with my team, Carol Winston and Courtney Christian, who's standing up back in the back. And we're small but mighty and really focused on looking at the issues of women's health and Black women's health very differently than I think we're probably used to. So a little bit about our vision. Obviously, we're committed to Black women's health, and after 32 years, we're still the only national organization focused on improving the health and wellness of the nation's 21 million Black women and girls. And our basic premise is that Black women are inherently strong and resilient and passionate about our health. And poverty, disease, obesity, and all these other things you hear about do not define us at all. So a little bit of history. As you know, most studies have focused on what's wrong with Black women. So we had the Heckler Report starting back in 1985, and since then we've had something like 2,000 papers, $200 billion in research, both academic research, program research, intervention research, and here we are where things are pretty much worse than they were 30 years ago, and there are a lot of reasons why. So we got the opportunity to work with the investigators of the Black Women's Health Study. And when I met Julie Palmer and talked to Tracy Bethay last year, I said, why not study healthy Black women? I mean, we can't all be sick. But of course, the way this work is funded, it's designed to look at what's wrong and not look at what's right. And so I'm really thankful that both Julie and Tracy thought this might be a good idea, because as their study shows, the majority of us describe our health as very good or excellent. So we don't define ourselves as sick and what's wrong. And when I first came on board at the Black Women's Health Imperative, one of the things we did is we just did a quick survey, just asking, you know, how do Black women define health? You know, what does health mean? So we just asked for words and phrases. And what we found was that the vast majority of the words and phrases Black women use, and I've asked Black women for the last year and a half, are not physical health. They're psychosocial. I'm at peace. I'm calm. I'm in control. That's about 85% of the words. About 10% of the words are financial. I can pay my bills. I can keep a roof over my head. I can take care of my family. Only about 5% of the words had anything to do with physical health. You know, I'm disease-free. I'm strong. And so, you know, what I heard, and I think what the team heard, was that women were saying, if I can get my head right and my spirit right and my money right, I can take care of everything else. And I think we know when Black women put their mind to doing something, we get it done. Okay? So in this work that we've been talking about, we very much have a missing population. You know, we don't study healthy Black women. We don't talk about them. You know, the media portrayal of us, you know, is very negative. And clearly there's some opportunities. And so our goal is to get us from about 9.5 million healthy Black women to 12 million in the next 4 or 5 years. So this work gives us the opportunity to change the conversation, to change the narrative, to look at us in a very different and positive way, which is the way we should be looking at us anyway. And this work will inform our programs and our messages, our advocacy, as well as that of other people and other organizations. It should. And it should absolutely inform the future of research going forward. Dr. Wright mentioned last week we were in this swirl about breast cancer guidelines. I mean, on the face of it, it just makes no sense. The studies that are quoted are from Sweden and Canada. There are no Black women in those studies. And yet, these organizations say, they report black women get cancer on average 5 to 7 years younger than white women. So why would you raise the age of screening? Automatically, that leaves us out. So clearly, there's some opportunities here. So this is why I'm really excited to talk about Index Us. It will be the first report ever on healthy black women and helping us to understand why black women are healthy and what it is about them. What do they do? Where do they live? How do they work? What do they think? How do they feel? What is it about healthy black women that we can learn from? And so I'm excited to partner with obviously the Black Women's Health Study, but also APHA, because this gives us an opportunity to develop a policy statement around black women's health. And to my knowledge, Dr. Wright, I don't think there is a policy statement on black women's health.
Women, but not
black women. So once again, no specific policy on black women's health. So what this index gives us the opportunity to do is to compare women's health across geography. So if you kind of think of the Dow Jones index, communities and cities can index themselves against a standard that will come out of the work that Dr. Pathe described. And it'll give us the opportunity to focus on behavior change, but also the structural changes that need to happen. I don't know if any of you were in the session this morning where we talked about structural racism, you know, being a killer, and it is. Mm-hmm. And you see it everywhere. So why not use this to inform that kind of research and those kinds of programs going forward? Also, it'll guide investments. I have a little bit of a for-profit background. And so I hear my colleagues talk about investing. And to Dr. Richardson's point, you know, we don't want to send the message that you don't want to hire black people or black women in particular because they're going to cost you so much money. The message needs to be quite the opposite. So in this report that will be released, actually it will be written next month, it will be finalized next month. We're going to do a launch in probably late January, early February. So if you sign in, we'll make sure that we send you a copy of the report. We're going to look at these key behaviors of black women by geography and have this comparative mechanism for cities and communities to use, but also create the business case for targeted investment. So, for example, I live in D.C., and Ward 7 is next to me. It has the highest breast cancer mortality in the country. Well, instead of sort of doing the, okay, we have some money, you all write us a proposal, give us your thoughts and ideas on how you might do an intervention, we can then use the information coming out of the study and say we want to essentially buy a 20% reduction in breast cancer mortality over the next 5 to 7 years. Bring the right people, the right partners together, invest in them so that they can just do that. They won't be distracted by trying to raise money, do other things that distract nonprofits. They can focus their time and talent and treasure on solving that problem. So imagine if we did that, what kind of improvements we could make, not only in black women's health, but in inequalities across the U.S. And in doing this, we also provide a new evidence base for policy changes. Again, not deficit, but asset-based. You know, what is it about healthy black women that we can apply across the country, and how do we use that to inform policy development, and how do you have the conversation with policymakers who are oriented naturally toward what's wrong? So in the index, because I have a little bit of a data background, I get really excited about this because we're also going to take the results of the study that Dr. Pathe described and crosswalk it with social media. So imagine you've got the epidemiologic data, and then you've got data on what black women are thinking and feeling and what they're talking about with their health. Imagine if you could crosswalk that. Then we can create predictive profiles. So we can look at women by decile, healthy black women by decile, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, understand know what we can learn about them, and then apply that to all of our programs and our policy work, our messaging, our marketing. Because frankly, public health people do a lousy job of selling health. So imagine if we could take what women are already thinking about health and what they're saying to each other when they go out for drinks and apply that to this work. We could really make significant improvements. So the report itself is called Index Us, the Black Women's Health Index. We did sort of noodle around with some other titles to the report. We were kind of thinking, you know, getting your groove back. Not a bad groove, I must admit. Tay Diggs reached out to me on Twitter, so haven't heard from him since, but anyway. But, you know, there's different kinds of grooves when it comes to health. There's this groove, which is not so bad at 72. But I think for most of us, this is probably where we are. You know, everyday women who are concerned about their health and their wellness, they do the things that they can. They eat right, they get some exercise, they manage their stress, hopefully, manage their finances, so that they can live an overall healthy and frankly, back to our definition of health, peaceful existence. So in these next few minutes, while this work will inform all kinds of interventions, policy and certainly structural interventions, I'm just going to sort of focus on what we might do for women, because we've got to send a strong message to women to let them know, Black women in particular, that there's nothing wrong with them. They really need to understand that, because we get very different messages all the time. So one of the subtitles might be the Black Women's Owner's Manual. So what is it that we can do? So first we start with your emotional health. Since we define health in terms of emotional terms, coming out of this study and the work that we will do at the Imperative to inform our work is to look at how we manage our stress. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is sort of the new in term now. But what we really can, there are some practical things that we can do. Breathing, first of all. We all want to have that flat belly, but frankly, if you breathe into your abdomen, you will lower your cortisol levels. Black women, for a variety of reasons, have higher cortisol levels. Cause a weathering effect on our body. It triggers our inflammatory response if we simply breathe. Somebody taught me 4-7-8. Breathe in for 4, hold your breath for 7, breathe out for 8. If you do that, literally in 15 minutes, you can lower your cortisol levels. So it's got an immediate health benefit. Create a list. I don't know how many people in this room are overwhelmed or have been overwhelmed at times by work and life and other things. Make a list. You have plenty of help. A very dear friend of mine said, make a list of everything that you need done. Make a list of everybody who can help you and draw lines between them. And then call them and say, I need help. There's no harm in asking for help, and it will lower your stress level. And just to kind of put a point on stress, some researchers looked at data from the Black Women's Health Study and saw that racism actually increased the likelihood for uterine fibroids. So racism... And I'm saying racism, not saying race. Racism is causes us all kinds, all manner of illness. And I just want to point that out because in these rooms, we often say race. This happens because of race. Race causes this. And the message we send is, oh, it's my fault because I'm Black, or it's my fault because I'm Latina, or it's my fault because I'm a Native woman. It's the effect of the lived experiences of being Black, of being Latina, being a Native woman in this society. It is not a biologic determinant. So, then we need to look at kind of, you know, what we do. I don't know if anybody, is anybody old enough to even recognize Martha? Martha. Nutrition and physical activity are really important. You know, she's dancing in the street. And from the study, what the researchers found is that healthy Black women describe them, their health is very good or excellent, walk. Well, recently there was a study out of Japan that said, in fact, walking is helpful. But you don't have to walk for 30 minutes briskly. They found that if you walked for 10 minutes 3 times a day, broken up, you got the same benefit as that 30 minutes. You could have a leisurely walk for 10 minutes. You could walk briskly for 10 minutes later on, have another leisurely walk for 10 minutes. And you got the same health benefit as that 30-minute run, walk, jog that we do. Coming out of the work and in this index, you will see all these sort of tips and techniques that women can do, like putting physical activity anywhere. We looked at another study out of Stanford that looked at the 7-minute circuit training using your own body weight. So 7 to 14 exercises you do in 7 minutes. You don't need any weights. You don't need any equipment. You don't need a gym. You can do it anywhere. At home, at work, waiting for your child to finish soccer or piano lessons. And it's really great because that 7 minutes has the same benefit as doing that 30-minute circuit training. So you'll see that in the index. You know, we've got to basically put being healthy in the way. So women literally have to trip over it, and we have to make it easy. And while the study also showed relationship with BMI and self-reported health, I would argue that BMI is probably not the best measure for us. We need to look perhaps at BMR, which nobody ever talks about. Nobody knows what their basal metabolic rate is, and look at body fat percentage. If you can get your body fat percentage somewhere around the 25% level or a little bit lower, that's going to help you much. That'll help you enormously, but it's also much more understandable than BMI because it doesn't mean the same thing, and you can't apply it. Serena, by BMI measures, considered obese. I don't see anything obese about that woman at all. And then, you know, the other sort of editorial comment is around the U.S. Open, you had the press, some in the press describing her as somehow not feminine or masculine or having an unfair advantage over the other tennis players. This is just pure power. And she embraced it fully, as she should have, as all of you should have, as well, all of you should as well. And then finally, we've got to do things a little different. I like Patti LaBelle because she always did things a little differently. Because financial health matters a lot, obviously, to your overall health. And so just kind of putting a finer, maybe a slightly finer point on what Dr. Benita said, we looked at the two counties that make up Atlanta. This is some work that I was involved in a few years ago. And looked at disparities, racial disparities in health, just in the two counties that comprise Atlanta. It's a $20 billion industry. So if we could eliminate racial disparities in black women's health, the amount of money that would be saved would fund all 100 low-performing schools in the state of Georgia. If we did that, high school graduation rates in the state increased by at least 40%, if not more, which adds an annual net benefit to the economy of $1 billion. So that becomes a real business case for black women's health. But then if you talk about reinvesting that, then you get this virtuous cycle. And you end up with, in Georgia, and this is just the two counties, but for the state, you raise 80% of impoverished black families out of poverty just by dealing with this one issue. So I think it's worth our attention, and I think it's worth a little more research. So what does that mean for all of you? I love this quote by Audre Lorde. We've got a lot of work to do. So I want you to follow us on social media. When the report comes out, download it, share it with your friends. After we release the report, we're going to conduct a number of listening sessions, and I would encourage you all, as many of you can, to participate in them. We're just going to go around the country and get responses, reactions, thoughts about what's in the report, help us in, you know, fine-tune it a little bit, and then hopefully roll it out so that all of you in your work can use bits and pieces of it, and it becomes a policy platform, because next year is an election year. And I can't say much more about that. But we envision having a State of Black Women conference where we bring stakeholders from across the country together to talk about how we get to 3 million more healthy black women in the next 5 years, because we all have a stake in this. Hopefully every woman in this room will practice what comes out of that index, those things that we can do to improve our health while we're working on the structural issues. And most of all, support each other. My organization started by the need to take care of each other. Billy saw this, and Gina's back there. She saw it. And that is something we absolutely have to do. And I was so thrilled yesterday when Dr. Kumanyika mentioned the Black Women's Health Project.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah, the only organization she mentioned in her talk. And she talked about something that I've heard Billy Avery say many, many times, we are the ones we're waiting for. So I like this Audre Lorde quote. And I would say to all of the women, the black women and all women, it's up to us to get our groove back. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Linda. And we do have time for questions, clarification, comments, feedback.
Yes. Hey.
Good morning. Thank you. That was wonderful.
Thanks.
I'm Carmen Nolfo. I'm with the Office of Health Equity in the California Department of Public Health.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for showing that picture of Billy Avery. I've been thinking about that a long time. You know, friend and colleague, my mother's after I called for you,
yeah.
For the birthing project.
Yep.
So I'm on my way to that conference after this one. But I wanted to say to you that I know the Office of Health Equity would very much love to support what's coming out with the index, possibly with the listening symbols that you're doing. And if there are there other ways that you could see the Department of Public Health
Absolutely. And the question is there a role for other departments of public health in this work? You know, one of the things that, you know, given all that we're talking about in health and all policies, that the theme of the conference is if we, one, could get public health officials to understand an asset base instead of a deficit base, because, you know, I understand how we're all trained. But also, the recommendations, the policy recommendations that will come from this report can absolutely inform your community-based work and the policy work. And it means, when we talk about systemic changes, but it's coming at systemic changes from a very different perspective and doing things we're not used to doing. So what I would love to do is to get with public health officials and talk about how we actually inform their work with this asset-based approach to it's Black women's health, but frankly, to all women's health, and use that in the programs and in the funding going forward for community-based work and policy work. So I will be in touch with you for sure. Thank you.
Can I just ask her a question? Mm-hmm. Are there a number of state-level offices of health equity common across the country?
Yes.
Okay.
There are offices of minority health.
Right, that I've heard, yes.
And so many of them
shifting?
Are shifting over to the offices of health equity, their resources very differently. So sometimes it's one person doing everything, which
is
kind of set up for failure.
Right,
and
yeah.
And sometimes they're resourced quite well, actually, to be able to do quite a bit of work. So, for example, in our office, we have $60 million to put out specifically for mental health initiatives. A fifth of that money will be going specifically to African-American mental health initiatives that really are coming out of African-American communities. And this is the kind of work that we want to be done in our communities, and we want also the evaluation funds to go into making sure that, you know, this work is well evaluated and it's going out. So it looks very differently from one state to the next.
All right. Thank you. That was helpful, because that can be an opportunity, a place to tap into when we're ready to convene the listening circle.
Right. Mm-hmm. And don't you all meet? The heads of you all meet
regularly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Across the country.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you so much for the information. My name is Tonya Schaefer, and I'm a family, and we have an Office of Behavioral Health Equity. But what I'm more excited about, and I just part of the effort serving to my father, what I'm more excited about is that we work with the state and the State Department of Health. The twist that you mentioned is something that they use to give us the guidance on when it's just with the money, as we look at health disparity, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So they're always looking at things in the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be very excited. I cannot wait to come to it. Again, I have to see it. I will be there.
Okay.
To make sure that our state can hold of that information just so they can see the twist that they can have as they look at data for Black women. Because right now, everyone just uses the national data set. They use NISA. They use data that, again, looks at the deficit.
Right.
And do not think of the asset base. So,
And wouldn't it be interesting?
Make sure you sign.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody, please. Okay.
Wouldn't it be interesting to look at, you know, and it depends on how much data we have. We can certainly look regionally, even if we can't look state by state. Because, I mean, this is Black women, and given where the study, you won't have, some states are just not going to be represented. But imagine if you could look at this by region or state by state, especially in the South, and do that comparative analysis and then use that to inform the work. Because I would guess if we, once we get to that point, looking at mental health issues, there's going to be a geographic variation. And I think the data already show that. So, yeah. And Gina.
I think one of the single most important aspects of this work is that everybody that even has a
bachelor's degree in public health, understands the concept of the sample must be representative and random in order to be applied to the whole population. And that most of the data that is created in this country that drives local public health departments, state public health departments, funding is based upon the samples that don't include us in a high enough proportion for it to have any relevance at all for us.
Right.
So I look at, I am the breast cancer liaison for the Black Women Self-Defense. I'm also a governing counselor here at APHA, and I'm a board member of Breast Cancer Action, which is we're the bad girls of breast cancer. that when we put out the data from the United States Public Health Task Force on mammograms, or even the American Cancer Society, we were not represented in the sample, and therefore the outcome, the implications, the action items don't pertain to us. They may or they may not. We don't know. What we do know is that Black women and Sephardic Jews get triple negative breast cancer at a much higher rate than anybody else. White women get breast cancer at slightly higher rates than we do.
Not anymore.
But we have
it just changed.
The mortality, twice the death rate of any other group. Why? Because we get triple negative breast cancer. There are no directed treatments for triple negative breast cancer. What we do know is it starts in an early age, the 20s or the 30s. It's very aggressive. People die early. And if you wait for a mammogram until you're 45, you won't be dead.
That's right.
Know your risk and pay attention. And don't ever give up on those self-risk.
The data just were published
this past week,
Black women have now caught up to white women in breast cancer incidence. So we no longer have a lower incidence than white women. Younger, we knew that, we knew what would happen with younger Black women, that they had a higher incidence, but now overall our incidence is the same. So we can't explain that through biology. So again, to your point, why would we raise the age, since we get breast cancer at a younger age, why would we raise the age?
And it only means the mortality rate is going
to
go up.
That's
only going to go up.
That's
right.
Exactly what it
means. Right. So this, none of these studies, obviously, because they didn't include Black women, but even the ones that the later studies don't take into account the lived experiences of Black women, and that is one of the critical issues that's missing out of all of the research.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kim. Okay.
But, I didn't know. So, from the nonprofit lens, from the philanthropic community, from the programmatic, the people that develop programs for minority communities. Mm-hmm. So, how do we use this information? How is it in a form that's applicable to what we're doing? I just think it's awesome. I just posted it.
So I'm going to appoint you a volunteer, then. Right.
I'm a social media platform. I'm connected to Black Women Run. So there's lots of different avenues that we can talk about this information. I'm always posting about it. So how do we put it in easy form that people can digest and get it, and really create a movement around this kind of asset-based approach to how we look at our health?
So we are in the process of doing that now. But part of what will come out of the listening sessions is information and guidance from women on how best to do that. So we've got some thoughts and we're going to start some things, but we need to hear from women across the country on the best way to have that conversation and talk about this in a way that they can hear it, understand it, and then act on it.
If I could just add to that really quickly, I think it's also important that when we're talking about communities to educate, to also educate researchers and academics. There is a very tight, there's a very limited mindset, and the people who are reviewing studies and deciding what gets funded and by how much, or even in, I go to a health disparities conference, and I think everybody would be support different types of work and want to think about how do we improve work. And some people, it's just a really interesting puzzle thing to solve. And it's important that we also help educate the people who are just really into science and found this thing that they could keep funded that happens to be triple negative breast cancer in African American women or in Latinas or in indigenous women, and that we kind of do that connection and activate that effective domain so that there's value to this work and that they're willing to work with communities, work with organizations like the Black Women's Health Imperative, not just add an advocacy group when they need to get grant funded,
right,
but are interested in investing in the future and making sure that their work has an impact beyond the publication in a high impact journal.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
So I would just like to advocate that okay. Going around the country and doing work in circles, that you consider going to areas that may not be highly populated by African Americans, such as Oregon. I'm from Portland, Oregon. A healthy Black woman is born and raised in Portland, Oregon. So there are more African Americans coming into that area, that region. Although it is perceived as being, not as diverse. If it's a funding issue, I'd be happy to have a conversation with you
okay.
to see how we create funds to make sure those don't suffer as well.
Okay. Thank you. That's a great point.
Okay.
Yes.
Because you got a co-sign on that, because I'm in Colorado.
Oh.
You're
the one.
So Colorado has a perception of being one of the healthiest states, but not for Black people. And so now there's a whole push for Black folks in Colorado to do something Black folks.
Ah, okay.
And so we can do that. And so making sure that when you're doing your communication plan, and I work for the Colorado School of Public Health on the academic side, is making sure that you are mapping where this message is going.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that there's just a definite, that there's a listening circle there. And I like the reasonable approach. But we have so much technology now that we can do listening tours via webinar and other to keep these groups engaged, because there's an energy of helping folks in these areas also. So if we're changing the narrative, making sure that we go to these areas where there can be different numbers and outcomes.
Right.
So that would be the only thing, that there's just a strategic map of where you're going and who, because I think there's networks in every city, in every state, to be a push to be within every state.
Right.
In some sort of impact. Yeah.
Right, right. That's a good point. There's no such thing as the hard to reach. You know, there's the hardly reach, but there, you can get to anybody if you want to.
Yeah, because, and it's easier to say, well, there's only 4% Black in Colorado, but what does 4% mean when we go into the actual number?
Right, right.
And it
right.
doesn't mean that there's a way for that number to turn.
That's
right.
Right,
right. Thank you.
Janita.
Oh, sorry, Janita. Oh, yes.
Because we know from the literature that when a Black woman shows up at a doctor's office with the same symptoms as other women, she is not granted the same screening protocol and attention, and we get the same question, are you depressed? Maybe from our clinician. And so there have been tools of medicine to be more culturally appropriate and interacting.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So that you get the correct data, but also reaching my target population. So you have robust samples, we can really use that data in the right capacity.
story that most people don't think about, how they don't really look at. I'm just wondering what outreach do you think you need or that you need to work in so that the federal government knows about this and also use your data for power teams programs in my industry.
Well, we work with the Office of Minority Health, Dr. Gracier, and so they're very aware of what we're doing, and so we're going to work with them on sort of a dissemination strategy at that level, because the agencies all have offices of women's health, offices of minority health, so that becomes sort of a federal government dissemination strategy. But then we've got the state that we have to deal with as well, and frankly, probably down to county and local dissemination strategy. So getting the word out is going to be a huge endeavor for us, and we're going to need, I think, all the help we can get. So if you'd like to volunteer, you know, maybe we put together sort of a nationwide communications advisory committee on how to do this. Yeah. Okay. Right. Exactly. Was there another question?
There was somebody else I thought on this. Oh, maybe that was you. Okay. Maybe.
So I just want to mention again?
Five more minutes.
Okay. So at the imperative, we sort of start at age 18, but I've had conversations with several colleagues who are interested in taking some of our work and pushing it down to high school. That's probably about as far as we've gotten so far, which I think is really important because all of this negative imagery, frankly, starts in preschool, to be honest. But if we can, you know, at least change that narrative, change the media discussion. And we can't probably change a lot of the imagery, but if we could just get to what's happening in news programming, talk shows, morning shows, just get a different kind of narrative into that, we slowly can begin to change the mindset while we work on structural issues. But it's really important, and so we're going to need some strategies for how to, working with partners to translate this down to middle school, down to elementary school. You know, how do you give that message to a 7-year-old girl that she's fine? You know, all she had to do was wake up in the morning, she's fine. Because she's learning when she sees her, classmate get kicked out of first grade for no particular reason. She internalizes that, and of course everybody knows what happens after years of internalized racism. So, okay, great. So I mentioned it, I just want to mention again that we will convene a national meeting called the State of Black Women, and stay tuned, we'll let you know when this happens, but you know, I would invite all of you to come because that's where we have the really big conversation about what happened. So it's not just research, it's for-profit, non-profit, it's the foundation industry, it's education, transportation, food, you know, all the social determinants, all of those voices need to be in the room as we literally chart the course to Black women's health in the next 5 years. So stay tuned, follow us, and look out for the announcements because I think it's going to be a really important meeting and, you know, one that is whose time is overdue, I believe. Okay. Thank you.